On Second Thought, I'm Virginia Prescott, live today from Georgia Public Broadcasting Savannah Bureau. We're in town for the Savannah Book Festival, and we're going to hear from some of the featured authors shortly. But even on the road, we're checking in with GPB politics reporter Stephen Fowler. He's on the line from our Atlanta HQ. Hello, Stephen.
Good morning, Virginia.
So let's jump into the week. The biggest news, Governor Brian Kemp announced the Patients First Act that would give him authorization to pursue waivers for Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act. So here he is speaking to reporters Wednesday afternoon.
We have a lot of issues in healthcare. We need more providers in rural Georgia. We need people to innovate and figure out ways to expand areas of service when you have counties that have no doctor at all.
So the governor's office says that this is its biggest priority other than passing the budget. What does it mean for healthcare in Georgia?
So, Virginia, the waiver process is to exempt some part of Georgia's health plan from the Medicaid and Affordable Care Act system. And what this means is it could help five people, could help 500,000 people, and it really depends on what is decided. They're bringing in these consultants to come in and look at Georgia's demographics and look at Georgia's health systems and figure out what ways they can go around and supplement these two plans to be able to expand health care for Georgians. Some of the areas it could address are people with mental health needs, substance abuse needs, maternal and infant mortality rates. Basically, it's a build-your-own plan for certain geographic and demographic groups.
So what time frame are we looking at to see any sort of change of that scale?
Well, if the Patients First Act passes, then the state will hire consultants. There'll be $1 million from the state and a matching $1 million from the federal government. And they're going to gather a metric ton of data about the state. And it'll take about 12 to 18 months because Governor Kemp would have to submit these waivers to the federal government by the end of next fiscal year. So that's June 2020.
Democrats are also making health care a priority this season, but taking a different tack. House Minority Leader Bob Trammell spoke last week on the floor about his proposal for Medicaid expansion. Let's hear from that.
And when we do the general appropriations for that, we need to look at covering these Georgians who are referenced in this fiscal note. And their only voice today will be the time that we give them looking at this fiscal note and the time in this well talking about their need and how we need to spend to address that need.
What does he mean by fiscal note, Stephen?
So the fiscal note is kind of this, they asked the budget office to figure out how much revenue a bill would bring in or how much something would cost to enact the bill. And the fiscal note for Medicaid expansion says it would cost about $150 million next fiscal year, starting in July, to insure more than 500,000 Georgians. But there's an asterisk to that bill that we'll get to in a little bit.
How would the Democrats' plan stack up against Governor Kemp's proposed plan?
Well, you know, so the governor's office is really light on specific details about what they want this to do because they want to give the consultants wide latitude. They say everything's on the table except for full Medicaid expansion. And the governor's office said it's a broken system that needs streamlining and fixing. We heard from Republican Senator Kay Kirkpatrick. She says the asterisk to that Medicaid expansion plan is that making sure everyone has a Medicaid card is all well and good. But she says if there's no doctor to take that insurance in rural areas and parts of the state, then having insurance doesn't really do anyone any good.
So Governor Kemp's plan is aiming at that in particular?
Well, it's going to do a little bit. They want more Georgians to have more insurance that's more affordable and more accessible, but the governor's plan is to kind of fix the system before, you know, opening the gates for everyone.
So let's turn now to work that has been done already. The first bill has been sent to the governor. We talked a little bit about it last week, but can you give us a quick update on the school bus safety bill?
Well, Virginia, as of about 15 minutes ago, Governor Kemp signed that school bus safety bill. The lawmakers were really all over this. It undid a bill that they passed last year regarding when you can pass a stop school bus. Basically, don't pass a school bus with a stop arm out unless you're on the other side of a divided highway with some sort of barrier or grass in the middle.
So last week, the House passed what is known as the little budget. That amends the budget for this fiscal year through June 30th. What kind of changes does the governor want to add, and how is the House responding?
So what we'll see in this budget is the school safety grant, $69 million for schools to have safety things, mental health counselor money to get to schools quicker, and they found some adjusted savings based on start dates for jobs that are started later than they had budgeted for. And the House managed to find $10 million $1 million in more Hurricane Michael relief for loans for these farmers that are still trying to recover. And that's important because the federal government took some of the hurricane relief money out of their spending plan that just passed. So it passed overwhelmingly in the House. There were 8 no votes, including that guy that votes no on pretty much everything,
which you told us about last week. So finally, Georgia's attorney general issued 2 criminal citations to former Atlanta mayor Kasim Reed's press secretary. What does that mean, and what does it mean for government transparency?
So this is the first criminal citation under the Georgia Open Records Act. And the former press secretary of Atlanta, Jenna Garland, sent text to another official saying that they needed to delay and obfuscate and block these open records requests from WSB, a TV station here in Atlanta, on a story they were doing about water bills. Now, it's a misdemeanor charge. And at the bottom of the press release, you know, it says innocent until proven guilty, et cetera. But it sends a big message about the government trying to make it harder for people to get records. So if you're going to make it harder to get records, which is illegal, you know, I would recommend not doing it in a way that's also subject to open records requests.
Note from GPB Stephen Fowler. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You can find Stephen most days at the State House in Atlanta covering the Capitol. Okay, so we said that we are at the Savannah Book Festival. We're broadcasting live from GPB Savannah, and we're in town for the festival. Savannah Now is going to be interviewing me on Facebook Live this afternoon if you'd like to see me squirm as the internet subject, the interview subject. But for now, I'm going to be the one asking the questions, and I'm thrilled to be speaking with Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya. His debut book, Friday Black, is a New York Times bestseller. Nana, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, thanks for being here on this early. It's Friday, actually.
Yeah. I don't own that day, but, you know.
You don't have the patents on it yet. Well, Friday Black is, of course, a twist on Black Friday, the ravenous competition to grab doorbuster deals. Now, you, reading this, there are a few stories about retail. You clearly worked in retail.
Yeah, I spent some time there, I guess. Now, fortunately, but, you know, back then I really felt unfortunately. But, yeah, I have spent some time working in retail.
Did you ever have to work on Black Friday?
I worked several Black Fridays, yes.
Okay, so what did you see there? Because there is a story here about, it's called Friday Black, and people are like zombies, you know, killing each other in order for deals, to get deals.
Yeah, you know, I've seen someone really step on someone else, like they're like, not like that on their face, but like on their leg or like to get to like jeans. In the first store I ever worked at, I was 16 at the time. And, you know, and I've also had done the thing where you come in the, I felt it got earlier and earlier, you know, eventually I was coming into the mall at like 10:30 and staying there till 9 p.m. or something the next day, just to, you know, watch people act crazy because of, I don't know, jackets. Mostly jackets, actually. I sold a lot of North Faces. I was like the North Face whisperer.
Oh, that's interesting, because there's a character in the book. He's the Ice King.
Yeah.
And he sells pole face jackets.
Yeah.
Really good at it.
Mm-hmm.
So you know that spiel. You know that how you size a customer up when they come in and figure out what they're going to spend.
Yeah, you know, there is a little bit of art to it. It kind of is making people feel like good about themselves, directing them to like what they were going to do anyways, sort of, I don't know, making them feel like they need this thing, but also just pushing them where they were trying to go anyways, I think.
Well, that's one of the amazing things that runs through this book. It's not just the crazy customers in retail. It is how people sell themselves to the world on some level. In this story called The Finkelstein Five, you use a blackness scale, 1 to 10, that the characters, they use to project themselves. How did you come up with that?
I think that, you know, a lot of us code switch depending on, like, the space we're in. And I think the difference for, like, Black people is, like, your safety or your ability to succeed in different spaces is sort of very much determined by your ability to do so. And so I thought, how can I represent that feeling of changing and presenting myself to fit a space, like, sort of this thing I know, like, sort of mentally make that, like, a actual physical reality of a story.
So your character wakes up in the morning, and he gets on the phone, and he adjusts his blackness scale. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, because he knows it's, like, a job, all of a sudden he's like, hi there, how are you doing today? You know, because, and again, I think a lot of people know that that's just a part of trying to get somewhere.
It reminded me of that movie. Did you see Sorry to Bother You?
Yeah,
Boots Riley's movie. So he's a young salesman, and an older salesman tells him, like, you got to put on your white voice.
Yeah, Yeah, and it's funny, like, you know, me and my friends, I could tell, like, he's who he's talking to when we used to live together in school just by the kind of the voice. You know, it's, again, like, it's not a thing we ever, like, spoke about prior, but it's just, like, a part of life, actually.
So how do you do that? Are you adjusting? You're code switching? And
I'm sure. Yeah, I do it all. I think, you know, part of what, to me, success is to not have to do it, actually. Hmm. But in life, for sure, absolutely. You know, to get a job, yes, completely.
So there's more on this story, the Finkelstein Five. It's said in the aftermath of five young kids brutally murdered in South Carolina. Why were they killed?
They were killed for nothing, really. But
what does the defendant say?
You know, they kind of are presented as because they were threatening. They were gonna be violent towards this sort of George Zimmerman stand-in character. Which is often like the case, you know, kind of just by being black and being in the world, you're sort of there's expectations of violence.
Mm-hmm. You know? They felt threatening.
Yeah.
But you take this to the surreal level. They're decapitated by chainsaw.
Yeah.
So we as readers know that we're not reading the news necessarily. Where are you bringing us there, Nana?
Yeah, I think the chainsaw, it makes it a little bit harder to like look away from it. And then also for me, it kind of asks the question, how bad does this have to be for you to care about this? Because we have this sort of like, I don't know, horrified feeling because of how it's happening. But I think we should be horrified now because black people are often killed and with impunity, and the murderers are let off with impunity. And I think because it's a gun, you know, it's like, okay, but for me, if you are killed with a chainsaw or a gun, you're dead either way. Mm. And so I'm kind of pushing on that sort of, that thing I sense that is like, you know, these people are killed and doesn't really matter. And I want to try to make it impossible to feel that way.
Right. So they're killed because this guy felt threatened.
Right.
And so this is a reference to these stand your ground laws, as you mentioned, George Zimmerman's defense for killing Trayvon Martin. And this comes up again in Zimmerland,
yeah,
which is a kind of a theme or adventure park where guests get to simulate murdering a black teen to defend their white suburban neighborhood.
Yeah.
Now, you were in college, back in college when that happened?
I was in college in Trayvon Martin was murdered, yeah.
So were the seeds of the story there for you then?
You know, I hadn't really come into myself as a writer fully yet or even at all. But what happened was me and my friends, we did actually, like, in response, anonymously create these, like, pamphlets. And we printed off, like, 500 copies and threw them around the campus. And, you know, I went to bed feeling really good about myself. Like, you know, we finally ended racism, you know?
Did anyone read them?
No one read it. I woke up hoping to see some big change. Nothing had happened at all. And I didn't like that feeling. But what I did know is that, like, you know, when I did end up writing the Finkelstein Five, I had that same feeling that I want someone to read this, even if my name isn't on it, you know?
Well, I wondered if, you know, now you're writing fiction, and this is a New York Times bestseller, so a lot more effective than pamphlets.
Yeah, and I learned something about that. It's important, like engagement, and I like fiction that is entertaining. You know, I don't think you have to be entertaining or educational, you know, or entertaining or culturally pertinent. You know, I think actually you have to be both, and so I try to be both.
Well, there's a lot of satire here. There's a kind of dystopian fiction, futuristic stories. So I want to get to them, but we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya. Coming up, we're going to hear more from him, learn about what inspires him and some of the people who have inspired him through the years. This is On Second Thought. We're broadcasting today from Savannah at our GPB bureau there, and we'll be talking more about guests at the Savannah Book Festival. Stay with us. I know that it's good. Won't you send it on my taste buds? I get way too petty. Won't you let me do the extras? Pull up on your block and break it down. We playing Tetris. AM to the PM, PM to the AM phone. Eat up your per diem. You just got to hate them phone. If I quit your BM, I still rock Mercedes phone. If I quit this season, I still be the greatest funk. My left stroke just went viral. Virginia Prescott on Second Thought is broadcasting from GBB in Savannah today. We're going to be at the Savannah Book Festival all weekend with authors like my guest, Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya. His short story collection, Friday Black, is a New York Times bestseller, getting a lot of attention. And he's going to be live at the book festival tomorrow morning at 10. So let's get to this. You know, these stories have been called Black Mirror meets Black Lives Matter. So a little twisted, a little futuristic, a little turned up. What does not writing straight fiction allow you to do?
I think it gives me just, it's like a freedom, you know? If I need something to exist in a world and it doesn't exist, I create it. And that's, you know, I guess that's just like a freedom for me. But also it's fun. I like the idea of getting someone to clearly visualize something that doesn't exist anywhere in the world. You know, that process is like fun for me.
And yeah, that's important. And they shift from, you know, there's different worlds in each of these stories. How detailed do you go into your kind of world building?
It's more detailed in my head than it usually ever gets in the story.
Yeah.
You know, I think I like to think of a lot of, especially with these short stories, you're getting sort of the tip of the iceberg. But I like to really imagine a world that this kind of situation might occur. And but beyond, and we're seeing like a snapshot in a day in the life of that world. But for me, usually I have like a great sense of like a lot of that world, actually.
So you're imagining like what the person eats for breakfast and how they get to work and all that.
I'm imagining like what even a job is in like a story like The Era. Like what do his parents do? Like what makes sense in like this world? What jobs don't exist anymore, you know?
Mm-hmm. The Era is set in the future. It feels very futuristic. And it's a story about perpetual war, really, that we're engaged in battle all the time. And thinking of, you know, Dr. King's arc of history, arc of the moral universe, do you see the future as being a more bigoted, more violent place?
You know, I think that it can be, yes. I think, like, you know, the arc of, you know, history, like, it bending towards, like, I don't know, justice or what is right. I think it does if you, like, stomp on it really hard. You know, I think you have to, like, really push it. And I think it's really easy to get complacent, and it's really easy to sort of accept a lot of brutality in the, that comes to us in the form of comfort. But it's often our comfort is someone else's sort of viciousness. And I think, like, being, like, keeping your eye on that is important.
Well, the stories are scary in many ways and vicious. Darkly humorous. How do you get a feel for how that works? How far to go in the humor? Do you ask people to read it? Do you just envision it?
I mean, I guess, like, you know, I kind of like go by what makes me laugh, you know? I think, again, like, I think something about the satire, sometimes the absurdity, it's kind of my way of saying to the reader, like, you know, this is an experiment we're doing with our brains right now, imagining this space. And luckily, we can imagine it. But for someone else, this is real. But I think when we peel back some of the sort of, I don't know, illusions of whatever we are, of sometimes just euphemism, the things we allow are absurd, and there's something funny about that. And not always ha-ha funny. Sometimes the punchline is actually it's not a joke at all. But I think there is something funny about a lot of things we accept. And I like to just, you know, sometimes play with that.
You dedicated this book to your mom. You said, for mom who said, how can you be bored? How did that encourage you?
Well, you know, my mom, again, African woman, she's Ghanaian. And I think people who have parents who are Ghanaian, they are very into, you know, they hate their children being idle more than anything else. And my mom said that before I was ever interested in writing. You know, she just saw me sitting there once, and she doesn't like being bored. But it did help me, like, later on, though. I can always be working on something. So thanks to her.
Thanks, Mom. So now you're teaching at Syracuse. You're going to be visiting with Savannah High School and college students today.
Yeah.
How do you talk to them about this world that you're painting?
You know, I emphasize that, like, you know, it's writing is a fun thing, and also, but it's also a purposeful thing. You know, there's also something important that you can do with your words, and also that, you know, your perspective, you specifically, whoever I'm talking to, you're getting that person on the page is what you're trying to do. And so I think, like, you know, everyone maybe potentially has something meaningful to write.
And a lot more powerful than pamphlets.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm out of the pamphlet game. Maybe someone else, that's their thing. But, yeah, you know, tell your story, and maybe something magic can happen.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Author Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya, he's going to be at the Savannah Book Festival again tomorrow morning at 10. You can go to our website, gpbnews.org, for details on the events, or you can look at the Savannah Book Festival website. All of the events are free, and it is just an amazing program. And we have another guest here from the Savannah Book Festival telling the story of the electric guitar, which revolutionized American music in the mid-20th century. But how it got from this to this. Primarily due to the lifelong rivalry of two men, Leo Fender and Les Paul. Music writer and editor Ian Port traces the thoroughly engrossing history of two visionaries who could not have been more different in his book, The Birth of Loud. Ian Port, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, a little background on these two men, born Clarence Leo Fender and Lester Palfus, not a great stage name, but both inveterate tinkers, both gained fame and lots of money by making this relatively quiet acoustic instrument loud. And you tell a story of Les Paul doing that in night, and he was in Waukesha, Wisconsin, only 14 years old, playing a solo gig. What motivated him to make his guitar louder?
Well, Les wanted to be heard, and you know, when he was a little kid playing at a barbecue stand outside of Waukesha, his hometown, he was told by a car hop outside of a roadside diner there that the audience couldn't hear him, could hear him singing because he was plugged in through a microphone, but not his guitar. So the story goes that one night, Les grabbed the phonograph needle from his father's record set, jabbed it into the top of his acoustic guitar, the soundboard, plugged the end of that into a radio, which is basically like what we now think of as a guitar amplifier, and played his guitar through the radio, and voila, he was heard. And from then on, Les was basically on a direct path to amplifying his electric guitar.
He made a little more money that gig, right?
Yes, he did. The tips doubled, he said, as he would like to tell it that way.
Well, Leo Fender couldn't be more different. He couldn't carry a tune or a beat, but he did have a radio repair business at the age of 13, so another prodigy.
Leo was a technical wizard. No one had high expectations for him as a kid. He was kind of today what we would now think of as like sort of a more introverted, sort of nerdy type guy. But he was a wizard at manipulating electronic circuitry and at kind of conjuring sounds out of radio technology. And that's really how he got into building electric guitars. You know, the guitar amplifier, as I said, it's not that different from a radio. So musicians came to him eventually looking for him to fix their guitar amplifiers. He said, hey, I can build a better one. And one thing led to another.
Yeah, and there's an aha moment for him. This is at a 1946 with Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. What happened?
Well, so, you know, Fender was famous for... he would build amplifiers for the musicians of Southern California, which at the time was a real hotbed of country music. It was actually the biggest country music market in the country at the time. And Fender loved country music. He would build amplifiers for these musicians. And if one of these groups was playing on stage and their amplifier sounded in a way that Leo Fender didn't like, he would be there and he would climb up on stage in the middle of the concert and start tinkering with the amp while they were playing a song. And he was famous for this. Finally, musicians got so tired of it that they had to tell him to stop doing that. And he got the point eventually, but he would do that, yeah.
Well, both Les and Leo were laughed at when they brought, you know, their hulking prototypes to guitar makers. But you illustrate how revolutionary the electric guitar was using the 1964 show. It's actually a movie. It was in movie theaters. Mm-hmm. Teenage Awards Music International, or TAMI. There's Jan and Dean. There's the Supremes. And here we have the Beach Boys. That all of us can recognize. There was also on that bill James Brown, Marvin Gaye, and the Rolling Stones. Let's hear a little of them. So two very different sounds there. But, you know, guitars had been, as you said, amplified but not electrified. So what is significant? What was unleashed with this sound?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine now just how different people thought of electric guitar back then. You know, initially it was like you plug in, you put some electronics in an acoustic guitar, it makes it a little bit louder, but it doesn't really like change the sound. And what we're talking about in this book is really the leap from that kind of acoustic era to the electric era, where they're saying, let's go fully electric, let's commit to this, let's build the body out of solid wood, and then it can get as loud as it wants because it doesn't feed back. And then you get that kind of piercing electrical sound that we hear with the Stones there and which the Beach Boys, which was really so different and so much louder and more powerful than what they had before.
But, you know, you also point out that, you know, there's no orchestra anymore. There's no sheet music. So what did that allow in American music?
Sure. So the one amazing sort of byproduct of this technical leap was that suddenly you didn't need 12 musicians on stage anymore to fill a room, right? Suddenly, when you had an 80-watt Fender amplifier on stage, or three or four of them, you know, four musicians like the Beach Boys could fill a room like the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium where the Tammy Show was filled. And that really changed the kind of sound and look in music. It also kind of deprofessionalized music in a way, because suddenly an amateur playing three chords on a guitar could make as much racket as a professional orchestra with a band leader and tuxedos and musicians reading music off of paper. So the electrification really changed the way that music sounded and looked and felt.
And could buy, right? Yeah. My guest is Ian Port. He's a former music editor for San Francisco Weekly. He's written for Rolling Stone, The Believer, and his book, we're talking about how the birth of the loud, that's his book, Leo Fender, Les Paul, and the guitar pioneering rivalry that shaped rock and roll. So Leo Fender, he started a booming business, mass producing inexpensive Esquire guitars, where they were called, gobbled up by hungry teens. Les Paul used frequent TV appearances with the singer and wife, Mary Ford, and worked with Gibson to sell his guitar. Now, they had worked together at one point, right?
What happened? That was what was so fascinating to me about this story. You know, everyone knows, like, the Fender Stratocaster and the Gibson Les Paul are kind of like, they're like the Apple and Microsoft of the electric guitar world, like the huge rivals. But before they were rivals, these two guys were tinkering together in a Hollywood garage way back in the late 40s, trying to find a different sound for the electric guitar. Les Paul was trying to find a sound that would make him famous because he wanted to be a star. And he thought, hey, if I get a cool electric guitar tone, I will suddenly not just be a sideman, I will be a star. Leo Fender, as you said, wanted to start a business. He had a fledgling kind of instrument company. And he felt that if he could mass produce electric instruments, then his, you know, his company would find success. And sure enough, that's what happened. But yeah, back in the day, they did work together. And it wasn't until the first Fender electric guitar came on the market, the Telecaster, that their friendship kind of fractured into a rivalry.
Mm-hmm. It's the story of American business.
Yes.
Sometimes cutthroat, yeah. By the way. But they had some extremely influential ambassadors of the sound, the surf rocker Dick Dale, a great, great series of stories about him working with Leo Fender, Muddy Waters, Growling Blues, Buddy Holly on the Ed Sullivan Show. So what did their influence mean for these competing guitar makers and the future, really, of rock music?
So much. I mean, it was so interesting to watch and to do the research and learn how, over the course of the 50s, all the guitar players tried the Gibson model or the Fender model. Gradually, they kind of came to favor the Fenders through the late 50s, and it wasn't until the mid-60s that Gibson really saw its resurgence into the kind of prominence that it has today with the Les Paul model. But, you know, these instruments really gave artists a new kind of voice, a new palette of sounds to work with. And that was what was so fun to do the research and watch that happen.
Well, and get in deep with these stories with musicians Carol Kaye, players like F.C. Hall. He left his job as the premier Fender salesman and bought the Rickenbacker Guitar Company, the choice of one extremely influential band. What did that mean? The Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. Seems like everybody of a certain generation watched it, and they had a Rickenbacker guitar. They had Rickenbacker guitars.
They did. So F.C. Hall, as you mentioned, had been the sort of financier of Fender early on. He got kicked out, bought Rickenbacker, and then unbeknownst to anyone, this random band from England that almost no one in the United States has heard of, much less wanted to be successful, showed up playing these Rickenbacker guitars. And overnight, Rickenbacker's business exploded, and the Fender people who were sitting there across town, literally like 5 miles away, saw their rival kind of have their business transformed overnight, and suddenly the biggest band in the world didn't play Fenders. It was a huge deal. Mm-hmm. And really, of course, now we associate the Beatles with Rickenbackers.
Well, these stories are so compelling. There's, you talk about Eric Clapton, Bob Dylan, Rolling Stones, deeply influenced by Buddy Holly, Muddy Waters, these early guitar heroes, let's say. Eric Clapton, playing with the Blues Breakers, played this kind of growling, gravelly guitar. And there's such a story there of Clapton buying a guitar for Jimi Hendrix while he was visiting London. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, so Clapton was set to jam with Jimi Hendrix a couple days into September 1970. He'd gone to found a white Stratocaster, which was sort of Jimmy's preferred look, and was going to bring it to him to the jam, only to find out that earlier that morning, I believe, Hendrix had died in his London apartment of his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the two of them were kind of chief rivals on the London blues scene, and you know, Clapton had related to Jimmy in a certain way, but you know, he was devastated by that loss, obviously.
But the guitar symbol there, what does knowing the stories of these two men and their influence add to our understanding of American music?
I think it just shows, you know, kind of the persistence of creativity and this how far people will go to get that creative drive out into the world and how fierce these people fought to be heard.
Well, we're going to leave you with Muddy Waters playing Hoochie Coochie Man as we thank you, Ian Fort.
Thank you very much.
He's going to be talking about his book, The Birth of Loud, tomorrow at the Lutheran Church Sanctuary at 11:20. That's at the Savannah Book Festival. Now coming up, Tina Clark. She's a Grammy-winning music producer and now author. She's at the Baptist Church Sanctuary at 10 tomorrow morning for the Savannah Book Festival. And we're going to talk with her about her memoir. That's when On Second Thought continues.
Past 21, I want you to believe me, baby. I have lots of fun. I'm a man. Yeah! I spell him H-I-N. That rubber band, man.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott with Tina Clark.
Gee, it's great after being out late, walking my baby back home. Arm in arm over meadow and farm, walking my baby back home.
Tina's new memoir, Southern Discomfort, recalls growing up in rural Mississippi during the Jim Crow era. Her real-life childhood reads like a Southern Gothic novel. More than once, she watched her mother, in an alcoholic fury, chasing her father, a successful, blatantly unfaithful husband, with a gun. Tina Clark came out and eventually left her small town for a big career in music. She produced records with Aretha Franklin, Natalie Cole's Grammy Award-winning Still Unforgettable. We're hearing a song from that now. Movie soundtracks and jingles. Perhaps you've heard of this one.
There's one place that's on your way. McDonald's is your break today. Have you had your break today? Easy does it McDonald's way.
What a road, Tina. And how fascinating hearing how you got here. Well, you yourself, I mean, you witnessed your parents fighting. The scenes are very distinct.
I think the things that you see as a child and growing up, they don't really leave you. And these scenes never left me, but they became maybe comical at some point instead of as painful.
But you observe your mom and your mother and father. Everything looked perfect from the outside. In fact, that was a big concern of theirs, that things looked good from the outside. But you knew your mom was not completely content in her beautiful house. What were you picking up on from her?
Well, I think that, I mean, my mom was my shero. She ended up being my shero and my best friend. But she, you know, was an aspiring songwriter. She had married my father. She was 15, he was 19. And she was very artistic. And she, you know, that was an outlet for her that she wanted. But that was one thing that he didn't know anything about music. He was a businessman. He was a self-taught, self-made, very, very successful, wealthy businessman. And anything that had to do with music or arts was just crazy stuff, you know, to him. So it did not go over well at all, my mother going to New Orleans to try to expand her writing career. She wrote with Leon Kellner, who was the orchestra leader at the Blue Room. And my mother, you know, never had success other than just a local kind of success. I have a ton of her 78s, but, you know, she was made to feel so important when she walked in there, because the orchestra would stop and he would say, "Ladies and gentlemen," and he would announce her in a song, and the band would start playing. That's what she thrived for, but it was always squashed. And, you know, she wanted to pursue her music, and she wanted my father to be faithful. And she never really got either.
And she she used alcohol a lot. She was often drinking, drunk when you were growing up, which made it completely unpredictable inside mm-hmm. of your household. You said you just wanted calm. And I'm guessing you were walking on eggshells, and you internalized that somehow this was your fault. How do you think that lived in you?
Well, I think I've always been an eternal optimist, even to fault sometimes. But this is a funny little story, but my mother told me the whole time I was growing up that, because I have three older sisters who are much older than me. And when they had me, my mother said I was the save the marriage baby that didn't save the marriage. So that starts you out at zero right there. And so you can only go up from there. So, you know, they divorced when I was 10. And as you'll read in the book, she left on my 10th birthday. And I used to think years ago, I grew up, really, I didn't want to celebrate any birthdays. And now I realize, and I wish more people, and women particularly, would realize that when you get that courage, when you have settled for so long in a relationship situation, and you've stayed because of money or power or whatever it may be, fear, or you're not educated. My mother, she was in the eighth grade when they got married, and that was it. And to be married to the most powerful man in that little town and all of these things. But after 28 years, it happened to be on my birthday. That's the way I look at it.
Well, I had this sense that you were kind of adultified very early.
Very early.
And you were even driving at 12, right?
Yeah, I got my first car at 12. I was given a... So, first of all, when I was adultified, I guess I've never used that word before.
Nor have I, but it seemed to work somehow.
You know, when she left on my 10th birthday, and it was on the 19th of December, and my father had, you know, he wasn't settled with the shock of her leaving, but he realized she was really gone. He dropped me off at the corner of the little front street town where I grew up and gave me a $100 bill, which my dad carried always wads of $100 bills on him. And he handed me a $100 bill and said, "Okay, go shopping for your sisters and whatever else you need to get anybody." And I remember him pulling off, and it was cold, and I was standing there, and I was right then at that moment, I believe that I made a decision and thought, okay, I'm not going to be sideswiped anymore with all these surprises and this volatile family and everything that's going on around it. It's time for me to buck up. I got to take care of myself. And I got to make my own decisions. And, I mean, it's like I played all this out in my head. And I think that's when things changed for me that day. Because up until that day, even with my mother being soused most of the time, everybody took care of me. You know, everything was done for me when I was little. But I was 10 years old now and was dropped off and my mother was gone. And it's like, okay, time to buck up. And that's what I did.
And that was also in December of 1963, so a month after John Kennedy had been assassinated.
Everything happened, it seemed like. It really did. It seemed like everything happened that year.
Well, so much was tumbling out at that time. You know, the throes of the civil rights movement just to come, and the violence, the disruption in American culture, which did not seem to reach Waynesboro for the most part. RFK's assassination, MLK, not much of a flicker in Waynesboro where you were. But you, Tina, you were a scrapper. You were a fighter, it seems like to me. You insisted that Virgie come and sit with you at the lunch counter and up in the front instead of out in the back door.
Virgie, my nanny.
Right. Her daughter, Cindy, you brought her when they were registering, secretly taking donations for the Klan, which you realize was really endangering them. It's really painful to read these now, you know, the mm-hmm. discomfort that they had. One misstep on their part could have been deadly for them. I'm trying to get at, did you have this just elevated sense of yourself? Because you were the daughter of this incredibly powerful man.
Absolutely. It was. I didn't realize that then. But I think looking back on it as I got older, absolutely, I felt that was my insurance. You know, when I stand up to the Klan, or when I bring a black person, my beloved, you know, Virgie, into the restaurant and integrate a restaurant for the first time in this little town, the only person I'm going to have to answer to is my daddy. Because anybody else, I mean, they know that I'm his daughter. So, yes, I did have that sense of security, and that's just being totally honest and transparent. My thought process at that age, I wanted them to have equality. I wanted Virgie to, who had never been in a restaurant in her entire life, and be actually served a meal that she wasn't serving. I thought this would be the greatest thing in the world for me to be the one to take this person I love so much into that restaurant and see her be served and not have to clean up the dishes. I thought with Cindy, I wanted to show these people in these white robes that a black person and a white person could sit in the front seat and they weren't going to do a damn thing about it. So in my heart, was the right thing. But then I realized when we walked out of that restaurant, and after everything that had happened, which you can read about in the book, I realized that I had put her in grave danger. Not only had I put her in grave danger, but I had pulled a very wonderful, shy human being. All she cared about was taking care of me, taking care of her children in her little home, her shack that she had 9 children in, never wanted to be noticed. And pulling her into that equality, what I thought actually was devastating, and I put her in a very dangerous place. And when I look back on it now, it saddens me greatly because I feel like it was selfish. I had an agenda. I wanted to prove something. I wanted to do it for her, but I wanted to do it for me too, I think. That's, I wanted to see her be treated equally.
We're hearing some of the reflection on the life of Tina Clark by Tina Clark, who's written a memoir called Southern Discomfort. It's about growing up in the South in the 1950s and 1960s. I'm curious about how you got started in the music business. You talked about how your mom loved music. She aspired to make records, did make some records. How did it come to you?
From the time I can remember, very, very young, my mother was always in her bedroom listening to, she had a turntable in her bedroom. She was always listening to Nat King Cole, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Ray Charles, Louis Armstrong, Sarah Vaughan, on and on and on. And I just grew up with that. I think, well, I know that it seeped inside my soul. And she said when I was even in the crib that I was constantly doing rhythms on the crib. And I guess that's how she knew I was going to be a drummer one day. But I used to beat on everything. Anything that I could hold, forks, knives, my hands, whatever. I was always playing rhythms until I actually started playing the drums.
So it was an encounter, I guess, with Stevie Wonder, if I read your history right?
Yes,
that,
I mean,
that
I was...
got you kind of launched?
I won't say that he launched my career. He gave me... He launched, I think, inside of me that instead of being a drummer, a musician, that I really wanted to be a writer, a songwriter. I had graduated from college. I was on the road with my band. We were touring. You know, the first place we came was Atlanta, Georgia. I remember I walked off the stage. My dad said that at graduation, I'd I had wanted to quit 2 years before and moved to LA with a band. And he told me that if I did that, he would never be there for me to fall back onto because I needed a degree, which was good advice, he said. But he said, because when this music foolishness that you're doing doesn't happen, at least you'll have a steady job and something that's a real career. Because to him, back then, women could only be, and not only be because I'm not saying it in that way, but women could be teachers. They could be what they called back then, secretaries. They could be...
Nurses?
Nurses, bank tellers. But, you know, there was a limit to this this career stuff, right? And he felt good because I got my degree, but I literally only got it because of him. So when I walked off the stage, I walked over, handed him my diploma, and gave him a hug. Went out to, my band was waiting with a van and a U-Haul trailer, and we took off to Atlanta, Georgia. That was our first gig, and that was in 1975, I think. So I was on the road for several years, and at the time I was playing, I was a house band in Biloxi, Mississippi, on the beach at a club. But I was also working part-time in Bogalusa, Louisiana, as a second engineer at, I think it was called Studio in the Country. Well, lo and behold, Stevie Wonder comes to record there. And so we just hit it off. And, you know, before he went back, he surprised me and came to this club to hear me play one night. And I was so nervous when he walked in and I saw it was him because everybody had been talking about how I played the drums. And my leg was shaking so bad. I think I was doing triplets on the bass drum with my foot. When he went back to L.A., he had someone to call me and say, do you want to come and hang out? I'm getting ready to cut a new album. I think you should come out here. Check it out. And I said, well, I don't have any money. I play in a band. How am I going to come to L.A.? And he goes, I'll buy you an airline ticket. I'll buy it one way. When you're ready to go back, you let me know. And you can stay as long as you want. So I went out to L.A. But before I went to my dad.
I can only imagine what your dad said.
I was so excited. You know, and they were divorced by then, of course, way divorced. And my mother was so excited because, of course, she knew who Stevie Wonder was. And she was like, you know, go, go, Hercules, Hercules, go, go. Run, Forrest, run. And my dad, so I was so excited. And I went to my dad and I was like, now, Daddy, I'm going to L.A. with Stevie Wonder. Well, he didn't have a clue of who Stevie Wonder was.
Mm-hmm.
But he had already heard the rumor. Can't imagine from who. Mm. But he had already heard the rumor about this. So somebody had told him that this man was a black man. So all he thought in his head, now you got to realize he knows I'm gay, but I don't think he even computed what that really meant. All he computed was I was going to California with a black man and I had fallen in love with this black man and going to California. And he was beside himself. He was livid. And so he said, if you go to California with that man, I will disown you right now from my will. And I looked at him and I said, see you, Daddy.
Tina Clark, we're so glad you're here. What a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been awesome.
And that is it for our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and The Raven Taylor. Our engineer is Alex Word, and Amy Kiley is senior producer. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.